notes are missing. Even then, they're likely to blame it on something else. Like that civil war of yours. It's not my civil war, Marsh snorted, and then remembered who he was talking to. Ma'am. The Emperor ignored it. Is there any way to use the collapse of this flow stream? The one from end to here? I can present the work and show the math behind it, Marsh said. But I'm going to warn you ahead of time that anyone who isn't already a flow physicist isn't going to follow it at all. And even then, they will argue what it means. It will take time for them to go through my father's work and his prediction model. But by then, it won't matter. Because more flow streams will have collapsed, and that will be the evidence. Marsh nodded again. Right. You said you knew that the flow stream from end to hub has already collapsed. It's very likely, yes. So you can predict the collapses. We can give you probabilities on which ones are going to collapse and when. It's not predicting. It's looking at the data and offering the most probable outcomes. Do you know which one is going to collapse next? I mean, which one is likeliest? Yes, it's likely to be the flow stream from here to Terhatum. The model predicts it will collapse within the next 6 weeks. Are you sure? No, but it's probable. How probable? Give me a percentage. I'd say about 80% chance you'll have the hub Terhatum collapse within 6 weeks. After that, it's hazy, but there's an almost 100% chance within a year. That's the streams to Terhatum and back? Mars shook his head. No. The flow streams to a system and from a system are not actually related. He caught the Emperor's look at this. I know that's not a fact everyone's brain is comfortable with, but it's true. Our model has a prediction from the stream from Terhatum to Hub, but it's very fuzzy because it's further out in time. It could happen in as soon as 38 months, or as late as 87 months from now. The second of those dates is when we expect the final streams to close. What will be the last stream to close? Right now, our prediction models have the stream to end closing sometime between 80 and 87 months from now. You carry all these numbers in your head? The Emperor asked. Not all of them, Mars confessed. Just the ones I thought you would ask me about. I have 15 minutes with you, ma'am. I wanted to be efficient. Do you find it at all ironic that end has the first flow stream to collapse and also might have the last? It's not ironic, ma'am. It's coincidental. But I'm happy it's likely to be the case. I want to be able to go home. The Emperor gave Mars a look. You traveled for the better part of a year without knowing whether or not you'd get a meeting with me. Begging your pardon, but I wasn't expecting to have a meeting with you at all. I was expecting your father. My condolences to you also, ma'am. Thank you. What would you have done if I hadn't decided to see you? I imagine I would have presented our data to the physicists at the University of Hubfall and told them it was their problem to get the information out to whomever wanted to listen. Then I might have taken a couple of days to sightsee and then headed out on the first ship going to End. Is that your plan now? To return to End immediately? My plan is done, ma'am. I've spoken to you. I am ready to give you the full report from my father, checked by me, which your father commissioned. You may pass it along to whomever you wish for verification, and you may do with it whatever you like in terms of policy. It doesn't seem like I need to convince you of the reality of the data. I'm confident you will use it wisely, although whether everyone else will follow your lead is an open question. The door opened, and Obeliz Atek entered the room. Mars rose. Lord Mars, your plan is done, but I still may need you. Will you stay? Ma'am, you are the Emperor, Mars said. No, the Emperor said, and for the first time, Mars heard exasperation in her voice. Lord Mars, you're not an office to redecorate. I'm asking you to stay, to explain this to me further, and to assist me in explaining it to others. I am asking you to stay, knowing right now there's a risk involved for you, and that risk gets larger the longer this takes. I can command your assistance, but I am asking for your help. Mars looked at the Emperor and was reminded again that Whatever he was expecting from this meeting, this wasn't it. "Ma'am, it would be my honor to assist you however I can," he said. The Emperor broke into a grin. "Thank you, Lord Mars. I am off now to tour a new tenor, but will be returning late this evening. Will you have a late supper with me? I have more questions." "Of course," Mars said, then hesitated. The Emperor caught it. "What is it?" "I'm trying to figure out my personal logistics. I'm staying at a hotel on Imperial Station. My dinner clothes are there. One, I'm going to be exhausted after touring this damn ship, so dinner will be very informal. Two, you're on staff now." The Emperor turned to Obelis. "I've hired Lord Mars as a special assistant for science policy. Have someone retrieve his effects from Imperial Station. Please find him quarters in the staff wing suitable to his station." She glanced over to Mars. "Make sure they don't look like a museum exploded in them. And have someone give him an orientation." "Yes, ma'am," Obelis said. "See you soon," the Emperor said to Mars. "Ma'am," Mars said, and bowed. The Emperor left her office. As soon as she crossed the threshold of the office door, three assistants and a bodyguard attached themselves to her and paced her as she walked through the anteroom. Mars watched her go and then turned to Obelis. "I have no idea what just happened here," he said. Obelis smiled. "It seems you had a successful meeting, Lord Mars. Now, come with me and let's see what we can find for you, apartment-wise." Chapter 16. Cardinia felt almost ashamed at how exhilarated she felt after her meeting with Mars Claremont. Ashamed because, after all, the discussion, as brief as it was, confirmed what her father had worried about, a worry she had inherited, that the human species was threatened with extinction, not in an abstract way or over a long period of time, but in a concrete fashion, in the span of less than a decade. In less than 10 years, every human system would be isolated, alone, and forced to survive solely on what resources existed in-system, and with what craft existed to exploit those resources. Habitats could theoretically last decades or even centuries before they failed, but there was the human element as well. Humans didn't react well to the knowledge they were cut off and doomed to slow death by habitat failure. Cardinia recalled what they knew about the fall of Dallas Isla. The humans malfunctioned long before their habitat did. Feeling exhilarated about a confirmation of that fate for 4 dozen human systems and billions of individual humans was nothing to be proud about. But Cardinia couldn't help it. She was exhilarated not because she was a fatalist or a misanthrope, happy that humanity was finally getting its comeuppance. She was exhilarated because finally the hazy, nebulous shape of her reign, one whose meager main accomplishment was keeping Parliament and the guilds from stomping on the unsuspecting planet of End with an influx of military boots, had suddenly snapped into focus. Cardinia now knew 3 things. 1, she would be the very last emperor of the interdependency. 2, the whole of her reign would be about saving as many human lives as possible by any and every means possible. 3, that meant the end of the lie of the interdependency. Which is what it was. And what Cardinia had learned that day she summoned Raquella the First in the memory room and made her explain it all. How the vast majorities of the star systems accessible by the flow were not easily habitable by humans, but how they proceeded anyway, undeterred. How these independent systems began to trade and become dependent on each other for resources. How a group of merchants, spearheaded by Banyaman Wu, realized true power rested not in trade, but in controlling access to the flow, and set themselves up in the hub system as armed toll collectors. How they camouflaged and sold their resource grab under a manufactured religious ethos of interdependency with Banyamin's daughter Rachela as the nominative figurehead of the new church and nascent empire. How the Wus and their allies paid off those who might oppose them with titles of nobility and commerce monopolies, creating the house and guild economic system that ensured a permanent caste system and actively discouraged the sort of economic diversification within each system that might now better position humanity to survive its imminent isolation. How, in short, the interdependency codified and manipulated humanity's actual need for intersystem trade and cooperation for the benefit of just a few at the very top, starting with the Wu family. Her family. Cardenia had been shocked at the simple, unapologetic, bloody-mindedness with which Rachela I had recounted the interdependency scheme. Until she remembered that the Rachela I of the memory room was a computer simulation without an ego. This version of Rachela I had no need to flatter herself or rationalize the actions she, her father, and the early Wu family and allies had taken. The computer simulation was unashamed. At that moment, it had occurred to Cardenia that every emperor after Rachela had had the same moment she was then having, the one where they had entered the memory room to converse with their ancestors about the nature of the interdependency, only to be told flatly that the founding story every interdependent citizen had been told and taught was a lie. Cardenia imagined that nearly every one of them had had to suspect. Her own dream about Nafa telling her it was a scam was a manifestation of her subconscious, not an actual ghostly visitation, after all. But it's one thing to suspect it, and another thing to be told it by the simulated but verifiable representation of your ancestor. Because she was curious, Cardenia had Gigi call up emperors at random to learn what they thought when they discovered, or had confirmed for them, that the interdependency was founded primarily to benefit the Wu family and their allies. She had wanted to know how it affected their own reigns. Some had been surprised by their ancestors' duplicity and used it as a spur to make the lives of the average interdependent citizen better. Some had been delighted by their ancestors' naked power grab and had gone about making sure that it stayed secured for further generations of the Wu family. Two were so appalled that they resigned, one self-exiling to End to become a farmer, and the other collapsing into nihilism, devoting himself to a life of drinking and fucking, as his simulation put it. But most emperors essentially shrugged and got on with the business of running the interdependency. How it was created and who benefited from it was academic to the fact that it did exist and needed running, and that there was nothing anyone could do that would change that, not even an emperor. Emperors of the interdependency were not meant to be radicals in any political direction. Ones that were found themselves discreetly removed and replaced by more tractable children, or, if necessary, cousins. Certainly Cardenia had spent the first 9 months of her reign being confronted with the immense inertia of the office of the emperor, and how tradition and obligation had hemmed her in. Was she not, right now, traveling by shuttle to tour a spaceship she didn't care about, at the request of a politically connected family she disliked, with a man everyone but her wanted her to marry? Was this not, in itself, a metaphor of her entire life at the moment? Now, however, the end of the interdependency was not only inevitable as a matter of physics, but desirable as a matter of species survival. The monopolies would have to go as each system gathered resources and prepared for their isolation. The guild and nobility structures would have to fall as impediments to the continuation of humanity. The lie of the interdependency, that it was necessary and desirable, was coming to an end. And Cardenia, who had never wanted to be emperor at all, would be the one to end it, would have to be the one to end it. She was almost giddy about that fact. "We're about to dock with the Sing out," the pilot of the Imperial shuttle said over the speakers, and Cardenia nodded. She was traveling with a full complement of assistants and guards, but at least some portion of the tour would be Amit and her alone, allowing the two of them moments of agreed-upon privacy to discuss whatever they felt like discussing. Cardenia assumed, on Amit's part, that would constitute some fumbling overtures of affection. "You don't have to pretend you might marry him now," a part of Cardenia's brain said. And that thought sent a pleasant shock through her system. It was true enough. The whole point of marrying Amit, or any Nohamapitan, would be to solidify the Imperial House's position with regard to the guilds and parliament, and to keep that wildly ambitious house in line, at least theoretically. But now, there was no future to consider, at least as far as the interdependency was concerned. Cardenia didn't need to worry about establishing imperial dominance for another generation, or currying favor with the guilds and the parliament. All that was going away. All that was left was striving to keep humanity alive after the fall. Cardenia was pretty sure she didn't need Amit or any Nohamapitan for that. If Mars Claremont was correct, and she strongly believed that he was, then within a few weeks, everyone would have all the proof they needed that the universe was changing. Cardenia thought briefly on Mars Claremont, with whom she had felt comfortable from the moment he entered her office, and laughed at it. Cardenia had intended the meeting to be private but formal, but something about Claremont made her change her mind. She dropped the formal address and fairly hovered over him while they spoke, and then maneuvered it so they could speak again later, over dinner. "You're attracted to him, duh," her brain said. Cardenia couldn't disagree with that. He was smart, well-mannered, and cute enough. And it had been long enough since Cardenia had any sort of relations that that combination in any man within 10 years of her age would have pinged her circuits. But it was something other than mere sexual attraction that Cardenia had responded to. As her shuttle docked, she realized what it was. Claremont had reminded her, just a little, of Nafa. A little academic, a little sardonic, and someone who might see her as Cardenia, not as Emperor Greyland II. Or at least, see her as Cardenia, too. "Maybe I just need a friend," she thought. She smiled wistfully at that, and then she exited the shuttle, into the bay of the If You Want to Sing Out, Sing Out, where Amit Nohamapitan was waiting for her, along with at least 200 workers who had built the ship. They all bowed as she descended into the bay. "Your Majesty," Amit Nohamapitan said as he drew himself up, "it is delightful to see you again." It was then that Cardenia caught the look on his face, a strained but pleasant mask, hiding something that was obviously stressing him. In spite of herself, Cardenia felt a momentary stab of pity for Amit. Whatever was going on with him right now, it wasn't pleasant. Cardenia returned the pleasantries and allowed herself to be introduced to the shipbuilders, shaking hands with the supervisors and greeting the rank-and-file workers. Cardenia had gotten used to this aspect of her job. She did a lot of greeting and waving and would for the rest of her life. "Well, not more," her brain said. She shushed it and turned to Amit. "Are you ready to begin the tour, Lord Amit?" she asked.
"Of course, ma'am," he said.
Cardenia held out her hand in a formal but not unfriendly position. Amit gratefully took it, and they walked out of the bay, followed by her retinue. A Tenor is a large ship, and there was quite a bit of walking planned. The tour would include the bridge and engineering capsule in the main body of the ship, and then the cargo holds and factories in the rings. It was during the part in the cargo hold that Amit and Cardenia would be alone, with her guards positioned in the ring sections behind and in front of them. Her people would have already been on the ship for hours, making sure it was entirely secure before she set foot on it, of course. It would be relatively low risk for her to walk 100 meters with Amit by herself. The whole tour would take just under 2 hours, followed by an intimate tea service, also just between Amit and Cardenia, at which, Cardenia suddenly decided, she intended to tell Amit that he could forget about the whole marriage thing. That decision being made, Cardenia hoped she wouldn't be too awkwardly quiet during the course of the tour. 10 minutes into the tour, however, it was clear that if either of them was being awkwardly silent, it was Amit Nohamapeeton. He was offering the bare minimum of banter required before letting crew members stationed at their tour stops take over explaining the functions of the ship. Amit didn't ask any questions, which might be interpreted as politeness, except for the level of distraction he was showing. He seemed not to be paying attention at all to the crew members' explanations of their stations and duties. At one point, Cardenia had to discreetly nudge him to get him to acknowledge and thank a crew member for their time. By the time the two of them slipped through the door of the cargo hold, the vast expanse of which was clearly placed into their itinerary to give the two of them a few moments of alone time, Cardenia decided she'd had enough. "Lord Amit, if this tour was meant to show your warm personal side to me, I'm afraid you're failing considerably," she said as they walked. Amit smiled ruefully. "Yes, Your Majesty. Believe me, I am very well aware of that. Is there a cause for this?"
"I received quite a lot of bad news today, I'm afraid."
"I'm sorry to hear that. Was it something personal?"
"In a way. Mostly business, although, as you know, business is often personal. I understand that better than most, I have to say."
"I have no doubt that you do," Amit said, and they walked a bit more in the cavern of the hold, quietly. When they got to what Cardenia expected was the dead center of the cargo bay, Amit stopped and turned to her. "You don't want to marry me, do you, Your Majesty?" Cardenia opened her mouth to say something placatingly, but then, no, I really don't," popped out. And, well, there it was. "All right, good," Amit said. "Wait, what?" Cardenia said, entirely surprised. "Begging your pardon, Lord Amit, but I was under the impression, from your sister most of all, that I was here to be charmed and wooed by you. You now being visibly relieved that I don't wish to marry you is unexpected, to say the least."
"I'm sorry, Your Majesty."
"I'm not," Cardenia said, and it was Amit's turn to be surprised. "I'm relieved that this tedious bit of politicking is over with. It means we might actually enjoy our tea together." Amit laughed at this. "But I don't understand why, after more than a year of a full push by your family and by you, that you're now relieved to learn that I have no interest in marrying you."
"It's complicated," Amit said.
Cardenia motioned around them as if to say, "We are totally alone. This is the time." "The short version is that we have been made aware that other houses believe we already exercise too much influence over you. At this point, we run the risk of losing influence rather than gaining it through close association with you."
"Well, I don't quite know what to make of that statement, Lord Amit."
"I understand, Your Majesty. Suffice to say that guild and parliamentary politics are complicated enough now, and we have reason to believe they are about to become even more complicated in the future." A warning went off in Cardenia's brain.
"How so?"
"The matter of end in the near term."
"And in the longer term?"
"Well, who can say in the longer term?" Amit said, and started to walk again.
"No,"
Cardenia said, and stayed where she was, obliging Amit to stop walking. "Excuse me, Lord Amit, I don't believe you'd throw away your path to the throne because of the rebellion on end. I don't believe your sister would do that either. There's something more to it, isn't there?"
Amit Nohamipeetan looked for all the world like a child caught raiding the cookie jar. And this calling off of the marriage attempt isn't something that you want, is it? Cardenia asked. Which is to say, this isn't your idea. You're being made to do it. By your sister?
Not by her, Amit said.
But you wouldn't abandon this on your own, Cardenia said. So, whatever reason you have for it, she signed off on it. But she told me that she was willing to give up her seat on the executive committee for you if I chose to marry you. Because the House of Nohamipeetan being on the executive committee is obviously trumped by the House of Nohamipeetan marrying into the royal family and placing an heir on the throne. So something has happened between when I talked to her and now. What is it, Lord Amit? Amit was silent. Is it about end? Cardenia pressed.
Your Majesty, you're involved in it in some way, aren't you?
The rebellion on end. Amit looked exasperated.
Your Majesty, why would we do that?
Cardenia ignored the condescension inherent in the exasperation because her mind was focused on the larger question. How would the Nohamipeetans benefit from a rebellion on end? If they were engaged in it in some way, it would mean they were either trying to win the favor of the sitting duke, install a new one, or possibly have a family member ascend to the throne. Grenny Nohamipeetan, the younger brother, perhaps. But why? If the sitting duke was deposed and the action could be traced to the Nohamipeetans, then the duke, or more likely his heirs, could force a suit in the interdependency courts, along with a request to escrow the house's profits pending the resolution of the suit. That would be bad for business. If the Nohamipeetans installed one of their own as Duke of End, then they would ultimately have to give up their home base of Terhatum, where Amit's mother Jedna was the sitting countess.
Terhatum.
The part of Cardenia's brain in charge of gestalting slammed everything together and shoved it into her consciousness. Oh my God, she said, looking at Amit. You know. You know about the flow.
I don't know what you're talking about,
Amit said, but his look of absolute surprise when Cardenia mentioned the flow called him a liar. You know it's about to collapse. You know that Terhatum is next. You're abandoning it for end. Cardenia stopped for a second and then stared at Amit, not comprehending. You know it's going to collapse, but you've done nothing to save your own people. Why? It's not collapsing, it's shifting, Amit started to say, and then clammed right the hell up. Cardenia continued to stare, and then her brain kicked in and realized what he said.
No, Lord Amit. Oh, no, they're not shifting. They're closing entirely.
Listen to me, you need to send a message to Terhatum today, right now. They have to get ready. They have to prepare.
Prepare for what?
For the collapse, Amit. For the collapse. Alarms went off, and from behind and in front, guards came rushing at the two of them. Amit looked around, shocked.
She wouldn't, he whispered. She wouldn't. Not to me. Not now.
What is it, Amit? Cardenia asked. He looked at her.
I'm sorry, Cardenia, he said.
And then they were both grabbed by guards and pulled away. Cardenia in the direction they came from, Amit in the direction they were going to go. Both groups got nearly to their respective doors when the cargo hold was torn apart by something slamming into the skin of the ship and driving itself at an angle toward the cargo hold deck. Cardenia turned as she simultaneously ran and was dragged and saw what looked like the remains of a shuttle barreling across the cargo hold, tip over tail, toward the far wall where Amit and his guards were running. She screamed his name, but it was lost in the shearing, tearing noise of the disintegrating shuttle and in the sucking noise of the air vomiting out through the gigantic hole in the cargo hold roof. For a fraction of a second, she saw the back of his head pushed down by the Imperial guards as they ran. Then they were all mowed down by the threshing wreckage of the shuttle. The ship, sensing the loss of atmosphere, began to drop pressure doors. Cardenia and her guards ran as fast as they could toward the falling doors, but the gale force winds of the ship's atmosphere sucking out the hole slowed them down. Cardenia screamed as the doors dropped lower, convinced they wouldn't make it. They didn't. Not all of them. Cardenia's guard shoved her at the door, and she tumbled, arms out. From the other side of the door, an arm reached out. A hand grabbed one of her hands and yanked her through the opening so roughly that she screamed out from the pain as her shoulder nearly dislocated. Then she was on the other side of the door, scrambling to get her foot out of the way as it slammed shut. Somewhere along the way, she lost a shoe. Cardenia was pulled up and dragged forcefully down the curving corridor toward the ring spoke that would send them back to the main body of the ship. When they were inside of one, she looked at the three guards who were with her and was about to ask what happened when there was a crack and a shove that pushed her hard into the deck, fracturing her wrist and abrading her arms and face as they were dragged across the surface. The wind howled again. One of her guards, who had stood up after falling, was pushed out of the ring section and was carried away before more pressure doors slammed down. When they were down, Cardenia counted to 10 before getting up off the deck. She gasped desperately for air. The two ruptures had thinned out so much of the ship's atmosphere in the ring that Cardenia felt like she was suffocating. One of the remaining guards, gasping herself, located a wall-mounted emergency kit and broke it open, fishing out the two small pressurized containers of oxygen inside of it. She handed one to Cardenia and showed her how to use it. Cardenia sucked down a gulp of the oxygen and was so grateful for it that she started to sob. The guard then checked on the other, who had not gotten up from the deck. Cardenia looked and saw a pool of blood surrounding the guard's head. He'd been pushed so hard into the deck that he'd hemorrhaged out. All around them, a huge, creaking, popping sound moaned through the surfaces of their ring segment and into the attenuated air. "What is that?" Cardenia asked. "The ring was rotating to help give it gravity," the guard said. "Now it's been ruptured. The ring is tearing itself apart." She reached over to Cardenia, offering up her hand. "Come on, ma'am. We need to get you up that spoke." The spoke was designed with push fields in mind. A wide walkway detoured off the main floor and up what appeared to be the wall of the ring segment and then into the spoke, with focused push fields securing crew as they walked up the wall to get to the spoke. The spokes emptied out into the main ship, with push fields securing the path on that end as well. "You first, ma'am," the guard said, and Cardenia limped up the wall, oxygen container in hand, and into the spoke, then turned back to look at the guard. "Keep going," she said, looking up, motioning Cardenia forward. And then the groaning noise became much louder. And from below the guard, Cardenia could see the deck of the ring segment begin to buckle and tear. A pressure door, this one to seal off the spoke, irised closed. The last image Cardenia had of the guard was her yelling at Cardenia to run. She didn't need the encouragement. She sprinted down the spoke until the push fields gave out, and then she was careening weightless down the spoke, first crashing into the wall and then dragging herself down it, trying to get to the far portal into the main ship. As Cardenia careened down, she passed a segment of the spoke with a transparent section. She looked out and saw the wreckage of the ship's ring and the segment opposite her tearing away from the ship, rupturing the spoke that led from it, spilling debris. She watched it as she floated past, and then it was behind her. In front of her was the portal to the main ship, which she now realized was sealed. A sharp, jolting crack shoved the spoke around Cardenia, slamming her into a wall and spinning her around. As she spun, she heard a high chorused whistling. Down the spoke was a rupture along the wall, little holes like pinpricks strung out in a rough line at least 3 meters long. The spoke was losing atmosphere. Cardenia clutched her oxygen canister tighter, pushed her way to the portal, separating her from the main ship, grabbed a handhold on the side of the portal, and started banging on the portal with her canister.
She kept at it as the air thinned and grew cold, taking occasional hits off the canister to remain conscious and banging. She kept at it until she either heard or hallucinated someone banging back on the other side. She kept at it until the cold took her. Chapter 17. Imperial guards swarmed through the House of Lagos offices in the Guild House, prompting what Kiva thought was the only rational response to the event. "What the fuck?" she demanded of Lord Pretar, who stood in his office while guards and investigators went through his files and tablet, along with the files and tablets of every other single person in the offices.
"There's been an assassination attempt against the Emperor," Pretar explained.
"Which has fuck all to do with us, how?"
Kiva demanded. "Lady Kiva, please," Pretar said, looking around at the guards. "Keep your tone respectful."
"Fuck tone," Kiva said. "Answer the goddamned question."
Kiva could see Pretar trying to decide if he, the senior director of the House of Lagos on Hub, could thump on the daughter of the matriarch of the house. After a second, he decided against it, which Kiva thought was the correct, although disappointing, choice, because she was itching for a chance to grind him directly into the fucking carpet right about now.
"The Emperor was touring a newly completed spaceship," he said. "Someone crashed a shuttle into the ring segment she was touring."
"Okay, and?"
"And the shuttle is from one of our ships."
"What?
Which ship?"
"The Yes, Sir."
"You have to be fucking kidding me," Kiva said.
Pretar looked around them and arched his eyes, which Kiva found spectacularly annoying, as if to say, "These people wouldn't be here if I were kidding."
"Lady Kiva," a voice said from behind her. She turned and saw a very officious-looking prick staring at her. "Who are you?"
"Hybrid Limbar, Chief of the Imperial Guard. I want to talk to you."
"Good, because I want to talk to you, too."
Kiva turned to Pretar.
"Out."
"It's my office," Pretar protested. "And you're not your mother, Lady Kiva."
"No, I'm not," Kiva said. "Call her and complain about me if you want. Until then, fuck off. I need your office."
Pretar stared for a moment, then exited. The guards and investigators in the office stared as he went.
Kiva motioned to them. "Tell the rest of them to fuck off too," she said to Limbar.
"Everyone, fuck off," Limbar said, "for the next 15 minutes.
Everyone fucked off, and Limbar closed the door behind them.
"So, how the fuck did one of our shuttles get jacked for this?" Kiva asked, walking over to Pretar's office chair and falling into it.
"It's funny you should ask me that, Lady Kiva," Limbar said. "I was going to ask the very same question of you, possibly with fewer fucks involved."
"Obviously, I have no idea."
"You were the owner's representative on the Yes, Sir."
"Yes?"
"And on your way back to Hub from End, you stuffed your ship full of emigrants from End, allegedly fleeing the civil war there."
"Yes."
"So?" "So it's possible one or more of these emigrants had plans once they got here."
Kiva snorted. "You're suggesting one of those assholes we shipped to Hub knew the Emperor, a brand new Emperor who was being crowned just about the time we left, was going to be on a particular ship at a particular time, and then just borrowed a shuttle to take her out?"
"I don't think that's likely. I think it's rather more likely someone here gave them instructions once they arrived and scoped out the political landscape."
"What does that mean?" Kiva asked.
"Lady Kiva, are you aware of the ship that was attacked?"
"No."
"It was the If You Want to Sing Out, Sing Out," which was a new tenor commissioned by the House of Nohama Peten.
Kiva said nothing.
"Lady Nohama Peten tells me that not too long before her house's ship was attacked, you and your mother, the Countess, threatened Amit Nohama Peten over a business dispute."
"We didn't threaten him. We just made very clear our displeasure over certain actions his house undertook against us on End, but offered to settle those issues out of court. You can ask him yourself."
"I would love to do that, except that he was with the Emperor when the attack happened. The Emperor survived. Amit Nohama Peten, alas, did not."
"Well, fuck," Kiva said after a minute.
Limbar nodded.
I can show you the pictures if you like. There's not much left, however. Most of what wasn't smeared onto the ship deck was ejected out into space.
You don't think we did that, do you?
Well, Lady Kiva, you tell me. You arrived from End with a business dispute against the Nohamapetans, and with a ship full of emigrants from a planet whose rebels have been attacking targets all around the Interdependency, and who have attempted to assassinate the Emperor before. So now, here is an assassination attempt that not only targets the Emperor, but also gets rid of the heir to the head of the House of Nohamapetan, and, incidentally, does immense financial damage to his house by destroying its new tenor just before it's deployed into service. Do you not see how I could imagine that you and these terrorists from End might have decided to assassinate two birds with one stone?
You can imagine anything you like, Kiva said. It doesn't mean that it's true. And it wouldn't make sense, anyway. We needed Lord Ahmet alive to push through the settlement we wanted from him. Killing him before we got that wouldn't do us any good. Now they're not going to have a goddamn thing to do with us, especially if they think we're involved.
Limbar smiled. That much, I expect, is true. Lady Nadashe is in a rage, and only the fact that she's currently whipping up support to send a troop ship to End is keeping her full attention from the House of Lagos. Kiva opened her mouth to say something about the Nohamapetan involvement with the rebels on End and why the fuck wasn't Limbar looking into that when she snapped her mouth closed so fast that her teeth actually clacked together.
Yes, Lady Kiva, Limbar said, noticing. Something just occurred to you?
I was wondering whether you have any evidence to back up your hunch here.
Limbar motioned around him. There is a reason we're here. I don't imagine you or your mother is stupid enough to commit any plans like this to recordable media if you were involved. But perhaps not everyone in your employ is that aware. In which case, we'll find out. In the meantime, Lady Kiva, you'll understand that I've restricted your movements to Hubfall for now, and that you'll be discreetly monitored in your movement. It's not just you, of course. Your mother, Lord Pretar, and most of your executives here on Hub and on Xion are also being restricted. That's not going to go over very well with my mother. Then you may tell the Countess, and you may quote me fully, that I don't give a fuck. Someone just tried to kill my Emperor for the second time on my watch. You can be assured that I will find out who it is. And if it is you, or your mother, or anyone involved with the House of Lagos, I won't care how high and mighty you are, or how much you intimidate your underlings. I'll take you down, and your entire house, if I have to.
I'll let her know.
Do that. And now, Lady Kiva, if you'll excuse me, my people have to get back to work. He went and opened the door to let his guards and investigators back into the room. Kiva watched them file in and then got out of the chair, left the office, and headed toward the elevator bank. As she did so, a guard detached herself from her duties and walked toward her.
"Oh, come on," Kiva said to the guard. "Your asshole boss said you would be discreet."
"This is discreet," the guard said, standing next to her. Kiva resisted the temptation to roll her eyes. "What's your name?"
"Sergeant Brynja Petov."
"Well, Sergeant, am I going to get a moment to myself between now and whenever the end of this is?"
"Not really, no."
"So you're going to watch me when I take a dump?"
"No."
"Good.
As long as the bathroom doesn't have a window or a second exit."
The elevator door opened and Kiva stepped inside. Sergeant Petov followed.
"Press the ground button," Kiva said.
"I'm supposed to follow you, Lady Kiva, not be your servant," Petov said. Then she pushed the button anyway.
"Where are you?" Captain Blanika said to Kiva over her tablet, the one the Imperial Guard hadn't confiscated.
"I'm in my hotel bathroom," Kiva said.
"What's that noise?"
"It's the shower."
"You're calling me from the shower?"
"No, I'm running the shower so I can talk to you. I have a fucking guard in my hotel room."
"What's the guard doing?"
"Lying on the bed after a particularly exhausting bout of screwing," Kiva thought, but did not say.
Kiva decided that as long as she was going to be that closely watched, she might as well get something out of it. Waiting for me to be done showering, so maybe let's get to the subject, which is, what the fuck happened with our shuttle?
It was coming back from Imperial Station when the communications went dead, and it piloted itself to the dock where the Sing-Out was being built and rammed itself into the damn thing. Imperial guardcraft opened up on it as it came in, but they didn't manage to destroy it before it hit.
Who was the pilot?
Ling Shi.
Kiva grimaced. She was completely competent and wholly uninteresting and had no personal politics as far as Kiva knew. It doesn't make sense that she would jam a shuttle into that ship.
I don't think she did, Blanika said.
We have the data from the shuttle's control panels. It shows a lot of activity during the trip, but no piloting data, or more accurately, piloting data that corresponds to the trip. Everything we see is what you'd see from a pilot trying to take control of the shuttle, not actively piloting it.
So you think it was hijacked?
Yes, I think it was hacked into somehow, and then either autopiloted or remotely piloted to the Sing-Out.
Did you tell that to the Imperial Guard?
They didn't ask, and I decided I'd let them figure it out. They just came onto the ship, downloaded everything they could, and set up shop in one of the cargo holds. They're still there. They questioned me and the senior staff, but that was hours ago. We're not allowed to leave. I don't know what they're up to right now.
There was no one else on the shuttle except she.
No.
What about before?
She piloted the shuttle to Imperial Station, yes? Was anyone with her then?
Hold on, Blanika said.
Kiva waited, and while she waited, decided that she really did need a shower. She and Sergeant Pitoff had been pretty exuberant. She stripped down, put her tablet into speaker mode, and got into the shower.
There were a couple of passengers, Blanika said when he came back on.
Three, actually. A husband and wife named Lewin, and a man named Broshning. They were departing the Yes Sir for good.
Do we know where they were going?
I have no idea.
But someone does, yes? Isn't there some way to find out?
I don't know. I'm a captain, not a private investigator.
Ask Gaz and Magnoot. If they had cargo in the holds that they didn't take on the shuttle with them, they would have to arrange to have it sent somewhere.
We just offload it. Imperial Station handles it from there.
Then have someone ask them.
Easier said than done.
We've got the fucking Imperial Guard thinking we're trying to assassinate the Emperor, Kiva said. I think we can make a little effort.
Blanika was quiet for a moment.
Do you have me on speaker?
Maybe.
I thought you said you were trying to avoid being heard. I decided I needed an actual shower more.
I wish I didn't know that.
Find those people for me. Tell me where they are.
No promises.
Then I guess I'll see you in prison.
Kiva heard Blanika sigh.
I'm not calling you back. I'm afraid of what you'll be doing when you pick up. I'll send you a message. Encrypted.
Obviously, Blanika said, and disconnected.
Kiva finished cleaning up, turned off the shower, toweled off, and opened the door to find Sergeant Pitoff directly on the other side.
You know there's an easier way to find those people, Pitoff said.
You fucking listened at the door? Kiva said, incredulous.
Yes.
What did you hear?
Most of what was said after you turned on the speaker.
You're unbelievable.
Just because we had sex doesn't mean I stopped doing my job, Lady Kiva.
Kiva opened her mouth and then closed it.
I have no good response to that, she said, finally.
Now tell me what you mean about there being an easier way to find these people.
Everyone who arrives at any Imperial Station for permanent immigration has to let customs know where they are staying. Immigration needs to keep track of them until they are cleared for permanent residency.
So customs knows where they are?
Probably.
Sometimes people lie about where they are going.
Pitoff shook her head. You have to present your hotel reservation or the name and address of the people with whom you are staying before you leave customs and check in once you arrive.
And then you walk out the door and are never heard from again.
At the very least, you'll be one step closer to finding them than you are at the moment.
So how do I talk to customs?
You don't. I do.
Why would you help me?
There's no reason I couldn't help you. Just as long as you know that I'm going to report everything I do for you to my boss.
Kiva arched an eyebrow. Probably not everything.
No, I'll report the sex, too.
This gave Kiva pause. Isn't it actually unethical to fuck the person you're trailing? Sergeant Pitoff shrugged. I was told to keep you close. Kiva laughed at this. I think I like you, Sergeant Pitoff. You're my kind of asshole.
Thank you, Lady Kiva.
Now, tell me those names again. I couldn't really make them out over the sound of your showering.
Taffet and Chun Lewin were staying on Imperial Station at a moderately priced hotel called the Primrose. That was no good for Kiva. She was stuck on Hub. She'd deal with them later. She was waiting for information on Girk Broshning when she heard a crash and then screaming in the hotel lobby. Kiva reached into the closet for a robe and then opened the door and looked down three floors into the hotel atrium and the crumpled body there looking up at the ceiling of the hotel 16 stories up.
Found him, Sergeant Pitoff said from the room.
She put on the other robe and walked out into the walkway to show Kiva the information on the tablet, which included a picture of Broshning. Kiva looked at it.
Pretty sure I just found him too, she said, and pointed to the body on the atrium floor, surrounded now by people, and which had now begun to leak.
Then she noticed something else and started walking down the hallway in her robe toward the elevators. Pitoff followed. On the lobby floor, Kiva walked into the atrium, past the dead body and the scrum of people around it, and over to one of the planters there, stuffed with attractive artificial plants. In the planter was a key card, nestled into the leaves of a large, fake succulent. Kiva snatched it up, walked again past the dead man and his admirers, and headed over to reception, where she got the attention of a very shaken-looking hotel assistant manager.
"Would you be a dear and ping Girk Broshning for me? He's expecting me, but I've forgotten his room number."
"Yes, of course," said the hotel assistant manager, activating his screen to search for the name and then swiping over to a communication panel to punch in the room code.
"No response, ma'am," he said after a minute.
"I don't suppose you could just tell me the room number."
"I'm sorry, ma'am, I'm not allowed to do that."
"Of course," Kiva said, and then turned just as Pitoff walked up to her.
Kiva walked straight past her minder and back onto the elevator, pressing the button for the 12th floor as Pitoff walked on. Pitoff noted the floor, but didn't say anything. On the 12th floor, Kiva got off, walked to room 1245, the number she had seen the assistant manager punch into his screen, and pressed the card to the door. It unlocked.
"You probably shouldn't follow me in here," she said to Pitoff. "You might be accused of tampering with the evidence."
In a bathrobe.
"Shut up and open the door," Pitoff said.
Kiva shrugged and went in.
The bed in the room was rumpled, but the sheets were not pulled back. Someone had lain on the bed, but maybe hadn't slept in it. Otherwise, the room was neat with suitcases and other effects unpacked. Kiva looked to the desk and found a notepad and a pen there, with letters on the sheet on the top of the notepad. She went over to the desk, and without touching it, read the words, written in a tight, small script.
"I grew maize and Banu on end," it said. "The Banu died because of a fungus. They say citrus caused it, but I think it was from the maize. It failed, too. I lost everything, and then the war forced me out. I tried to leave, but I couldn't afford it. Then, Granny Nohama Peaton asked to see me, told me he'd pay my way, said he felt responsible for what happened to my Banu, said I had been a good franchisee. He said when I arrived at Hub to contact a customs official named Kay Isolt, who would tell me what to do from there. Isolt came onto the ship and gave me a transmitter box, told me to leave it on the shuttle when I departed. I did. Then, when I came to the hotel, I turned on the monitor and found out what happened to the shuttle. I know they'll figure out how it happened. I know they'll find me. I know no one will believe me. I've already lost so much and have been played for a fool. I thought I might have a chance for a new life on Hub. I was wrong. Sorry for the mess.
Motherfucking Nohama Petons, Kiva said, and turned to Pitoff. Do you have your tablet?
Pitoff held it up.
Call your boss.
What do you want me to tell him?
Tell him I found something that gets me and my house off a goddamn hook.
He's not going to be convinced by a suicide note, Pitoff said.
It's not just a suicide note, Kiva said.
It's still going to take some time.
Kiva nodded. Yeah, when you're done, let me use your tablet.
Why?
Because I need to call my captain and tell him to stop looking for Broshning. And then I'm going to call someone else.
Who?
Someone I'm pretty sure can speed up the process of getting my house off the hook a whole fucking lot. Chapter 18. The Imperial Guard pushed the door open, and Marse Claremont walked into the ornate and cavernous room where the executive committee was having its first meeting of the morning. Marse sported a folder and eyes as large as plates as he took in the Baroque design of the immense room and realized that no matter how long he stayed at the Imperial Palace, he would probably never get used to its ridiculous sumptuousness. It was, in a word, excessive. He reached the table where the executive committee sat, save the Emperor, who was still recovering from her assassination attempt. The member at the head of the table, the one Greyland II told him would be Archbishop Corbine, assayed him quietly. Marse bowed to her and briefly scanned the table for the other person he was looking for, Nadashe Nohama Petin. He'd never seen her before, but he recognized her quickly enough, younger than any other member of the executive committee, and bearing a strong family resemblance to her brother Grenny. She looked back at him, neutral, as she should have, because she had no idea who he was or what he represented.
"You're new," Archbishop Corbine said to him.
Marse nodded.
"Yes, Your Grace. I am Marse Claremont, the Emperor's new assistant for science policy. I was hired just yesterday on my arrival from End."
This got Nadashe's attention, but she hid it well. If Marse hadn't been directly looking for a reaction, he would have missed it. Corbine smiled and acknowledged the committee.
"This might be a lot for your second day."
"Yes, Your Grace, it's a lot. More than you know."
"I understand you have an update for us on the Emperor's condition," Corbine said.
"I do, and I have another piece of business that the Emperor wished me to present to the committee, if you will indulge her wishes."
"Of course."
"The Emperor's condition is improving," Marse said. "She's still suffering from the effects of cold and hypoxia from being trapped in that leaking tenor spoke, but fortunately her guards, or what remained of them, were able to retrieve her before she suffered any genuinely life-threatening injuries. She was lucky. Luckier than the 5 guards who were lost protecting her, and the 4 guards who were lost trying to rescue Lord Amit Nohama Petin." He turned and nodded to Nadashe. "My condolences, Lady Nadashe, for your loss."
"Thank you,"
she said.
"Of course."
Marse turned back to Corbine. "Dr. Drinnen has told her that he wants to keep her on bed rest and observation for a few more days, to let her body heal further, and suggested to her that this executive committee be allowed to handle any issues that come up. I believe he was hinting to her that this committee should take on the parliamentary authorization of force against End and its rebels."
"What did the Emperor say to this?"
Corbine asked. "She said that, absent her presence, the committee may act in her stead to implement the authorization."
"No time like the present," said Upeksha Ranatunga, who in Parliament had voted to send the troopship Prophecies of Raikela to End. "But only after I presented this committee with the second piece of information she wished to share with you."
"And what is that?"
Corbine asked.
"This," Marse said, and opened the folder he was carrying.
which contained 9 printed documents, each containing a substantial number of pages stapled together. He began distributing the report to the committee members.
"What is this?" Ranatunga asked.
"It's an early draft of a scientific paper my father received several years ago from a doctoral candidate named..."